Look, adenylyl cyclase is a molecule which is making this really relative well-characterized, very important second messenger molecule, cyclic AMP. Originally, it was thought that evolutionary developed, let's say, 2 billion years ago, and then it diverged in the bacterial form and in the already characterized form in mammals. And now we find out, wait a minute, in mammals, there is an enzyme, which the one which we purified, which does not look at all like the known ones making the substance, but like the ones in bacteria. And look, this is simply great. Yeah. Or another episode of which happened now, let's say, 4 months ago, we were purifying, cloning, and expressing an enzyme which is making a retinoid which is killing cells. And we did that in moth. And now, 4 months ago, we were able to show that the substance is really produced, the one which we hoped which would be produced in moth, that it is produced in moth. You know, and the moment you see this on your instrument, look, there were bets in the lab against me, which said, you are dreaming, this will not happen. But the moment after one single experiment of 50 minutes, nobody could dispute it anymore. And you know you are right. You know,
why? How do you know you are right? In the face of this, obviously, if they're betting against you, critics in the audience,
yeah.
You know, how do you know that you're right?
Look, we simply took one pupae and delipidated it, put the lipids on reversed phase an HPLC machine, and on the screen there was the product which we were looking for. That was a dream come true. Look, my idea, my hope would have been that I see a small blip, which that I can afterwards take 100 pupae and force it if it's there. But one single animal, and boom, the substance was there in a way that somebody who knows how the substances look, you know, knows that's it, no doubt. That's great.
And why?
Why it's great?
Yeah.
Because this opens a total new field. On the other side, look, I invested, idealized, 2-3 years on that damn thing.
Okay.
And
okay.
Look, and it sometimes my idea hold. Sometimes,
okay.
Most of the time, not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes it holds, and that's great.
Yeah.
Look, and as long as this experience is happening at least, you know, happening sometimes, let's say once a year, you know, it's worthwhile doing that stuff.
Okay. Well, this is what you said, I think, off the tape, is that, you know, science is like 2 great moments a year, and the rest is an exercise in masochism.
Oh, you have to be a masochist to be a scientist.
And,
You
so what so to just go back, because I want to pursue this to this line, because what makes you persevere? So the adenylyl cyclase is one of those moments that you live for.
Oh, yeah.
The SF21
enzyme, right.
That produces AR,
right.
Is one of those other ones.
Yeah.
So would you say the discovery of HRR?
Was a great, but look, that's now already 8 years.
It's
not fresh.
Yeah.
Right.
And so what's the criteria? What's the criteria for these great moments that decides whether they're great or just not so good?
What is the criteria for these great moments?
What makes a great moment?
Is it a great moment?
The fact that you approved, you know, your idea proved to be right, that you won the bet, you created a new field, you've introduced a new paradigm, that you got a paper out of it. I mean, there's all
Look,
different kinds of criteria.
The paper story, that's the future. That's not so important.
Okay.
So
what drives you? What's your standard for success, your criteria for success?
You know, essentially that you start with a problem, you try to tackle it, and you really have to put effort in. I never reached anything like that without effort, without sleepless nights. And then sometimes at non-expected moments, qualitatively something is happening and you see something qualitative new which is true. It's like a mathematical proof that you got now something. Science does not work as a total evolutionary small progress. Science very often works that you work hard, you seem to make some progress, everything is crashing. And like Sisyphus, if you are, you start simply again and try it a little bit different. And then sometimes what's happening is that you get this moments where you are able, contrary to Sisyphus, to push the stone over the hump. And you know you have it, you are over it. You know, these are great moments. And writing papers, writing grants, that's cleanup work, you know. Mm. But most of the time, these are not trivial findings. These are findings at least where you judge where something new, a new idea, a new quality is happening, you know. I could not imagine to have this feeling with something like finding simply a new gene,
okay.
Purifying a new protein. That's this is day-to-day work, you know.
Okay.
So
your work where you purified even more new retroretinoids is kind of just everyday work.
Okay, I tell you exactly in this context what I mean. We found 14-hydroxyretroretinol, and then we wanted to know, we found that in mammalian cells, how far can we go down in evolution and find the substance? And we still found it in fly cells. Mm-hmm. However, in fly cells, there was a second retroretinoid. By itself, interesting, fine.
Yeah.
So we decided to characterize the second retroretinoid. And I thought, okay, the flies simply have two and it could be interchanged. That you can use either this or the other. And I remember how a grad student was testing an hydroretinol on its effect on cells, and he claimed that at very low concentration he saw some effects. That it's similar like 14-hydroxy can keep cells more happy. And it seemed strange. And the next thing I heard afterwards was that a hydroretinoid seems to be toxic. But why would it then be in fly cells, you know? Why would they produce that? And one day it hit me that why could it not be that an hydroretinol and 14-hydroxyretroretinol could be like yin and yang? That one keeps the cells alive and the other one is now doing the opposite and killing the cells. And then doing that in a competitive way by binding to the same receptor. So that one stimulates the receptor and the other one sits there but does not stimulate and does the opposite. And essentially what this, then having this idea and simply testing that now in tissue culture, this getting then the result that this yin and yang exists, this is again one of these moments where you do qualitatively something new and of the exciting moments you live for. So look that, yeah, that a dogma is toppled over, you know?
Yeah,
I think.
And how do you decide when to pursue something, when to keep pushing the ball up the stone up the hill, or to just let it stay at the bottom and cut your losses and pursue something else?
No.
Pursue another idea.
I do not have a clean answer for that, and this is one of the difficulties I sometimes have. I think that maybe that's the difference which makes the difference between a good and an excellent scientist. Looking at the people I had in my lab, the ones who know to follow up these tough questions, these are the real good ones. And the ones who simply always have explanations why their stuff did not work, and the ones who are unable to see. Look, essentially, interesting questions always start when the common explanations do not fit. And so you have to ask, why do you get these results? And look, all the stuff I think I ever did was seen by people before. However, they did not make connections. I think this is, and I bet that I oversaw many things. However, I think a good scientist at least finds things he can tackle, you know, and there's so much stuff out. We know so little. And, you know, the big thing is, the great thing is, I think that we as basic scientists have a big, big luxury. Essentially, we are allowed to be curious like a kid. They simply allow us, as long as we are funded, to do what, you know, what comes to our mind, and this is great. Essentially, yeah.
And who is they?
Whoever gives us money.
Okay. We'll pick up this issue of money probably tomorrow. Where does creative science come from?
Where does creative science come from? I think that,
and
I think that creative science, I think, needs the same qualities as creativity in art. And this means that you need a combination of, I think creativity needs knowledge, creativity needs a little bit of naivety, a little bit childlike ideas, you know, simply a bit to playing. Yeah. What else is part of creativity? No, look, if I see my kids playing, they are creative, you know? And essentially, I think that this is one of the qualities we never should disrupt in kids. And perhaps I had this luck that they allowed me to play. And
your parents or your superiors here?
Starting with my parents until whoever.
You still play?
I still play.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's look, it's the same way that Hannes is my son. Is playing with his toys and putting them in different order. And look, that's the same what we do with our data. And what's happening is that sometimes new questions come out of that. And let's see what's happening. And
What is?
You go. But look, it's the same when creative people make music. It's the same. But look, don't think that artists do not have to know their craft. You better know how to play your guitar if you want to make noise.
So it's knowledge still.
Yeah, and really it's effort. I do not know of one creative person who does not spend hours on it, you know, and years. Yeah.
And in terms of science, what is creative science? How would you define creative science?
Creative science.
Is all science creative?
Definitely not.
Okay.
But who are the creative scientists? There are not so many out. No, these are people who with some background knowledge and with play with ideas and look. If you really look at the great inventions in science, these were always inventions other peers told them it cannot be. But what seems to happen in science is that the limit is our own creativity and our imagination. And then the moment somebody proposed something new, first people will deny it, but afterwards all the people claim they saw it too already years ago, you know? Who are the creative people? No, one thing is strange. Again, it has something to do with gut. In a way, I would say I know them. It's strange. And this was one of the experiences with Pew, by the way, that I found creative people through my life. But in the context of science, the Pew group and the Pew meetings were really the place where I found overproportionally creative people.
And how do you account for that?
Could be the selection, you know. I think they are looking for people like that. It looks like.
And so, if you look around a room, how do you, what do you base your criteria on that a person's going to be creative?
You know, of being part of being creative is simply to ask questions and not to stop asking and not accepting dogmas. And essentially, whenever I have a very good non-creative postdoc in the moment, one of my people. This person always wants to prove dogmas. And she has an higher than average, she's much more often, her hypotheses are more often true than mine. But she's not creative because she exactly wants to prove the wrong thing. She wants to prove the status quo. And this is so boring. We need these people. They are great to work out glitches, you know. But they never will make jumps. This postdoc really fears new things. So it cannot be. So if you have a result which does not fit, you do it another 5-6 times, change the condition until it fits again in your dogma. And, yeah. one thing really could be true that of creativity, I do not see a big difference between good scientists and good creative artists. I get the very same feeling from these people. And yeah. And look, to be creative, you still need a little bit this childlike wondering, that you are astonished of what's around you. If you do, yeah, the moment you miss that, I think creativity is gone. Yeah.
And how do you train a graduate student and postdocs? How do you train people to be creative scientists?
You cannot train them.
So creative scientists are born?
You have it or you do not have it. And what I mean with it, I think if you do not have it as a young adult, way before you make it to grad school, you will not get it. You either have this curiosity or you do not have it. You can be a good scientist. You can be a good worker in the sciences, let's say it that way. We need people in quality control. We need people in companies for that stuff. Yeah. And it's also our duty in academia to train people like that. And we should, yeah.
So is that a general curiosity about things around you, or is that a curiosity in science that you need to be born with in order to be a creative scientist? Is it a kind of a curiosity that's very general in scope, just curious, just being curious, or being curious about things, how things in the natural world work?
You know, looking at me, I think I could be in biological sciences. The way I'm in the moment, I could be as well in physics. I could be as well in whatever. I think simply I myself, I really like to be me. I need a creative profession, you know? Or otherwise, what would I do? Otherwise, I would become park ranger on Yellowstone, which would be a dream.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why would that be a dream?
Oh, if you would ask me, what would you like to do when you are 65? I would tell you my dream would be to be to work, to have a lab for 3 months, 4 months, here in New York City, because I really like the city, to have a lab for 4 months in Maine, in Acadia National Park, and a Jackson lab, because it's a beautiful landscape, and for another 3 months be a park ranger in Yellowstone. Really, I mean it. And I would like to do evening programs and hikes, and for another 4 weeks visit my kids. This is my dream of my old age. Yeah, and that would be fantastic.
Yeah. So what role does environment play in the creative process? Whether
environment?
That's science in New York City or science in Bar Harbor? Or
look, luckily, I need nature. What I spent perhaps out of the last 20 years most of my vacations hiking. Hiking through the Alps, hiking here in the national parks, going with the backpack for days. And this is also stuff, you know, where you can recharge, where you can creative. As strange as it sounds, hiking has this, for me at least, this walking in nature in a sort of meditative state where thoughts are coming and going. And look, what is creativity? Connecting different thoughts, you know, which okay. seem to be non-connected, to see a connection where there was no connection okay. before. I think that's creativity. Mm. And here, at least I enjoy doing it in Look, and for creativity, you cannot do it when you are tense. Whenever you are tense, nothing works. Whenever you have to do stuff, or at least I cannot do it. Or if I have to do stuff, I have to start doing it early. That there's no pressure, you know.
Well, you had mentioned yesterday that you thought your father found his profession in teaching.
Yeah.
And how would you, have you found your profession in science or biomedical research?
Yeah. It's one of the, it was one of the possibilities in me, and I like it. Okay, yeah, I like it. Would I do it again? Sure. However, would the same things happen, the same chance events? I do not know. Look, I think I could be as happy in other professions, as long as creativity is involved. Or the job has to be so minimal that I would have enough time on the side to do stuff I like. Yeah.
Okay, well, pursue this just a little bit, and then we can stop for the day. You had mentioned, we talked just a few minutes ago about how, you know, curiosity kind of is almost an instinct, and that you either have it or you don't, and that's a part of being a successful creative scientist.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had also mentioned, would these chance opportunities still happen? What role does serendipity play? So you have a creative, curious person trained in the scientists, possessed of scientific knowledge, but mm-hmm. then what role does chance play in the creation of a good and successful scientist?
Yeah. You know, chance plays a big, big, big role. However, look, I see here the development of a scientist similar to the development of a human being. The same way that, look, my son Hannes, he's a very smart, creative kid. And look, he's at the same stage as a human being as a very good, smart grad student we sometimes have. And now it's by chance where they develop. But if they learn to deal with the base, you know, if they learn how to learn, if they know that they have to put some effort behind something, if they know that they are allowed to follow their the moment, let's say it. I think that Hannes will be fine as well as this young scientist. He, in my opinion, he does not have to follow an academic career. However, he should do his stuff right, you know? And it's so typical, looking here at this students here in the starting in the PhD or MD PhD program and so on, being with them for a short period of time, you know it. You know whether they will whether they are able to go in the to make it in life or not. You know, some of them have it. It's so strange to say that, but here with the scientists, I think I know. And now, do they become what is now success? The one person I'm thinking about in the moment, a grad student, he's, by the way, not in my lab, but I follow him since in the last few years. Where will he end up as a very, very good smart scientist and a productive person? But this does not mean that the other ones, which do not have it, not will be good medical, not good scientific technicians, let's say it that way.
Okay.
Yeah. Look, I think that's the difference, that many people with PhDs will spend their life as medical technicians. This means using the stuff they learned as a technology. And then there are some people who are able to play with it. Yeah. And I think this is the difference between an excellent scientist and a medical PhD technician or MD technician, yeah, or whatsoever. Yeah.
So, and chance then has no role in determining those fates?
Yes, it has. Because, look, these creative people, they would be creative either in natural sciences or in other stuff they choose, you know? This guy I have in front of me who really could become a top scientist, could as well make it as a top creative person in a different field. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, if I would not have gone to work with these disabled kids, I would not sit here today. If I would not like avant-garde music, I would not sit here today. So, sure, chance.
Last question, I promise I'll stop. So given that there are these different, well, within a lab, there is different roles for different people, grad students, technicians, postdocs, PIs, but also in this world that I see you depicting of, you know, good scientists who, are good technicians, mm-hmm. and then the good scientists who are the creative,
right.
you know, drivers of
right,
science,
right.
is there is there some kind of hierarchy in science? Are you painting a picture of a science with some kind of hierarchical structure?
Look, not a hierarchy in the sense of titles. When I deal with the... I'm running the second year MD PhD course. With these people, it's really fun to deal on the same level, you know. These are smart men and women. It's fun to discuss stuff with them. Look, however, I'm sometimes, perhaps I am a little bit arrogant. What I mean with that is that I hate pretenders. And whenever I get it that people talk about pretend knowing stuff they do not know, or I very often simply do not listen. And, yeah. This is one of my personality traits where I have to be careful. Yeah, sometimes I do not. I simply go in my own fantasy land and let them talk or walk away. And yeah, that's sometimes old. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're at a good place to stop for today. Mm-hmm. So we'll pick up tomorrow. Thanks.
Sure.